You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a group of lectures entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding. It is Collected Works, Volume 338, and is translated by Rory Bradley. 12 lectures and question and answer session held in Stuttgart on January 1st and 2nd, and February 12th through the 17th, 1921. And this is part one. It had Working on Behalf of the Threefold Social Organism, a Training Course for Speakers. Lecture 1, given in Stuttgart on February 12th, 1921. Today we will first discuss the possible intentions of those individuals who are taking part in this course, and how we might best gain a foothold in our tasks. If you seek to fulfill the intentions connected with this course, then in the near future you all will go out into the world to do work on behalf of the threefold social organism. In our current historical moment, this work is of the most eminent necessity, and this conviction that it is so necessary must be our starting point. We must declare that it is high time that we go to work for this threefolding impulse, which we must regard as an absolute requirement for the life of present-day civilization. Since in the next few days we are going to discuss the requirements for doing this work, you must be able from the very start to shut out all skepticism in your hearts toward the importance of the threefolding impulse. You will not be able to do this work if you are skeptical about this at all. During this training course, you will come to see that it is not only what you do or say that has an effect in the world, but also certain imponderable, inexpressible things must accompany your speech and actions if you truly want to be effective. Furthermore, you must be clear that all of the old forces of civilization to which this decadent age clings are rebelling against this threefolding impulse, forming oppositional groups. We have much to fight against if we want to use our power to bring the threefold social organism into reality. And the more success we have on one side, the more we will have to fight on the other. Such successes as evidenced by the experiences with our opponents this week do not lessen the intensity of the fight, but rather cause it to continue escalating. And we will have to arm ourselves for the fight that is coming. Which is not to say, of course, that we should all go rushing into battle. Doing so will not bring about any progress. But we must all be aware of how intensely this fight will unfold in the near future, precisely in the moment we achieve something in our work. What I would like to offer today will come primarily in the form of several psychological starting points. Obviously, it can only be a matter here of describing the functional foundations of your work. I would like to emphasize from the start that it is not possible to offer some sort of handbook for speaking about political social matters or about anything else. What is important is that we create a positive foundation for working on behalf of the threefolding impulse. And for this reason, you may feel at first as though I am being far too general when I begin by introducing several very general rules. Nevertheless, if we truly think through these rules concretely, they will prove to be of exceptional importance to us. In the work that you intend to do, you will get somewhere only when you work out of two foundational forces in your soul. Since we are dealing, currently, with a more than ordinary degree of seriousness that must infuse these matters, must ensoul our work, we should first make ourselves aware, totally aware, that we will not progress at all if we do not develop these two fundamental soul forces. First of all, we must speak out of a genuine love for the subject. Second, we must speak out of a love for humanity that is filled with insight. Be clear with yourselves about this. If these two preconditions are not met, or if they are replaced by some other force, such as ambition or vanity, you will still be able to deliver very logical speeches to people. You will be able to speak very cleverly. However, you will not be able to achieve anything. At the core, the requirements for working through speech do not lie only in the formation and use of words. You need only to start looking at the way things are most often achieved through words now, and you will see for yourself everything that I have been saying to you. Imagine for a moment two speakers are presenting in front of an audience. One of them is an unknown individual with unusually powerful insights, penetrating powers of speech, and full authority on the matter at hand. Then another speaker steps before that same audience, the way things are these days. This man has held some sort of public position for a long time, whether it be as deputy of such and such, or statesman from somewhere or other, the great industrialist, well known in one place or another, or the great scholar of X. This second man would speak with far less penetrating motifs and themes, would articulate a position with far less authority and justification. The efficacy of a work in the world is necessarily dependent upon the content of spoken words. But we certainly cannot establish our work on the sort of rhetorical flourishes or authoritative positions that I have just described. There are also two sole conditions that must characterize our speech. Those are the sole conditions that I just mentioned: the genuine love of the cause, which is the only thing that can support the necessary inner conviction, and the love of humanity. It is self-evident that these two soul forces cannot replace the content of the spoken word. That this content must also be indisputable goes without saying. But the content of our words will have no effect when it is not supported by the two soul forces of which I have spoken. For that reason, it is absolutely necessary in our time to say, since we are more inclined to, shall we say, dismiss such technicalities, that we must all examine the extent to which we have both of these forces within our souls. If we discover that we do not have them, it would perhaps be better that we do not take part in the important actions that are to be undertaken, because all that we bring to them, all of our work, will be wasted. And we must also be of the conviction that any work coming out of other impulses can never be of great impact, whereas any work that has conviction and comes out of a love for the cause, and also for humanity, will perhaps only have a small effect at first, but it will nevertheless be a true effect. My dear friends, the truth chooses all manner of invisible paths by which to enter humanity. It is the case that any time both of these imponderables, love for the cause and love for humanity, are present, an effect in the world will result, even if it does not come to light immediately. In one way or another, it will come into the world. Of that we can be sure. But other things must also be part of that work. A full insight into the inner nature of the subject must be present when we speak in public about something like the threefolding impulse. We also cannot allow ourselves to give in to any illusions about the soul constitution of the people to whom we are speaking, or about the conditions that exist in the world that require us to speak to people now. Among our contemporaries, there is no shortage of people who are capable of taking up the things we have to say to them. But because the majority of leading figures at present are the way they are, it is also true that the powers of those individuals who would be capable of taking up the threefolding impulse are suppressed and in a rather brutal manner. If we avoid generalities as much as possible, we necessarily come almost immediately to a discussion of details. When you come to people with something like this, the most typical thing they say is, quote, "Yes, but in Central Europe we are experiencing a crisis and a tremendous amount of poverty. We have to fight just to get stale bread. Our primary concern right now is economics. What good are high ideals? What is the use of things spoken on the basis of spirit?" Close quote. You will hear this objection expressed in a wide variety of ways. And we cannot deny that it is spoken by souls in a truly desperate situation. From a purely material perspective, this objection has a certain justification. But if we allow the most important questions of the present to pass before our souls, the questions that could become the foundations of our work, we will see that the view that the only important concern right now is solving the economic situation is based completely on illusion. It comes out of a different question, or perhaps the answer to that question, which people take to be self-evident, but it is not self-evident. It is based on the premise that humanity, not this person or that person, but humanity as a whole, is not to blame for the present conditions of the civilized world. We will talk about this in more detail shortly. If we take a moment to consider the economic system that has overtaken the world, and it is necessary to do just this now, then we have to say to ourselves, quote, "Nature will provide us with the same amount that it did at any other time in history, if we are able to properly harness it, and if we are able to bring the fruits of our labor properly into human life," close quote, into all of human life, of course. That humanity is in a more desperate situation today than it ever has been before is not a result of physical changes. Rather, it is a result of the human spirit. If humanity finds itself in a crisis today, that crisis is a result of a false spirit, a false way of thinking. For that reason, the only thing that can be done to bring us out of this crisis is to replace the false thinking with proper thinking. Neither nature nor any sort of unknown forces have brought humanity to its current position. Humanity itself has brought about these things. If there is a crisis, then humanity has caused this crisis. If people do not have anything to eat, then it is people who have not provided this food. It is important that we not start with the false premise that some sort of unknown force has brought about this crisis, and we must first overcome this crisis before we can start talking about proper thinking. We must be clear that since this crisis was caused by the improper thinking of human beings, only proper thinking can bring about the end of this crisis. We must consider, from all possible sides, this mistaken belief that if you can give people enough bread to eat, then once they have enough bread, they will arrive at proper thinking. This is a terrible misconception. And nothing that will actually bring about salvation can penetrate in today's civilized world if we do not all decide to turn away from this misconception, to replace it with a correct conviction that a reversal, a reformation of thinking about the nature of the world itself must enter humanity now. This is precisely the conviction that must gradually find its way into a sufficiently large number of minds. We, however, will find ourselves able to speak to these people only if we do not have any illusions about two things. The first of these is the fact that generally at present there is no awareness of the productivity of spiritual life. The nonsense that resulted in the saying, quote, "competence is all you need," close quote, the saying is not nonsense, but the way in which it was used, this nonsense must, in light of the things that are happening out there in the civilized world now, be altogether banished from the human mind. For the events of the civilized world show that a certain select number of altogether incompetent people are always carried to the heights of leadership by some aspect of their nature. We are living now in an era that particularly values incompetence. We'll also speak in some detail about this, and we'll have to seek the forces that led to this selection of so many incompetent people at this moment in history. I would, however, ask you please to remember that for as long as we are speaking here among ourselves and creating the necessary preconditions for our work, we must all stand firmly on this conscious foundation, that the threefolding impulse is altogether correct, that we are not at all skeptical toward it, that we see in it the only power that can lead us out of the confusions of the present. Only by standing on this foundation will we be able to avoid taking the things that I am about to say as presumptuous, or something of the sort. These things are said because they are intimately related to creating the preconditions for our work. Take my book titled Towards Social Renewal. If you consider the way in which it is taken up by many people these days, and if you take a look what is put forward by its opponents, and if you then try to make some sort of judgment about the things that lie behind what the opponents say, you will be able to arrive at these underlying things only by psychological means, through psychological observations. The opponents, mostly, talk over and around the content of Toward Social Renewal. For the most part, what they say is almost no relationship to the actual content of the book. For example, I recently discussed the content of Toward Social Renewal in Bern. After my talk, the economist from the university spoke for 3/4 of an hour. In not one single sentence did he succeed in addressing the actual content of Toward Social Renewal. That is an absolute fact. And he also did not properly address the content of my lecture. He was completely unprepared, not knowing Toward Social Renewal at all. Now, what do people feel when they approach the ideas of the threefold social organism? Why is it that they build up these things from the deep foundations of their souls that are so out of keeping with it? They do this because they sense that it is something altogether unusual. Without being fully conscious of it, they sense what is active within themselves. They feel that if the threefolding impulse, as it is described in Toward Social Renewal, were to take root in the world, then it would elevate those who are capable and knock from their pedestal those who are incompetent. The impulse that lies within the threefold social organism is one that will have a big effect as soon as it is brought into humanity. But its effectiveness is such that it takes away the effectiveness of all those who are incapable. This is what people feel in the depths of their unconscious. Naturally, they are not able to say this, which is why they end up saying the things they do. If you take the time to examine psychologically the things that people say, that is, to analyze the ways in which they have an effect in the world, then you will arrive at a corroboration of what I have just said. And in the end, all of this is related to the fact that at present there is no awareness of spiritual productivity. People have grown too accustomed to allowing the spiritual life to be borne by impersonal things or by people who are not in the least bit spiritual. That is, by the state or by state figures who do not have their own living spirituality at all. You need only take these things one by one. Need only ask yourself, what do the people in theology departments want? In theology departments, at present, people are far less interested in delving into the secrets of the primal spiritual forces of the world than they are in producing religious bureaucrats who are useful for the state or for hearing confessions. In jurisprudence, it is not about seeking the foundations and the essence of law. Rather, it is about teaching people what is customary in one state or another, about things that were established by people who also had no interest in the essence of law, but who wrote laws on the basis of one set of interests or another. And it is possible to go through everything that plays a leading role in spiritual life and see that in every case an awareness of the productive element of spirit that must be born up in civilization, an awareness of the living effect of the spirit on the human soul, is barely present. Over time, people have been gradually nurtured toward a crippled intellectuality, toward merely thinking without filling their thinking through and through with initiative from the will. People are being taken in by crudely considered thinking. You will see this firsthand when you give your lectures. You will be able to experience again and again the way in which the people who listen to you are contented simply to have heard one thing or another. People have a certain lustfulness for thoughts. They feel content with them. They would like best simply to hear what satisfies a certain inner desire. But they actually become inwardly furious if you suggest to them that words should not remain merely as words, but rather, if the words are to truly have any results, that the entire being of every individual should be filled by them, and that those people should then take part in life from the perspective that the words open up to them. In the last few centuries, people have simply grown too accustomed to taking up words in a particular way. When they sat themselves down in the church pews and listened to the priests in the pulpit, the sermon was supposed to be, in quotes, beautiful. It was thereby meant to warm, with a decidedly Philistine warmth, everyone's inner lives. People came to feel a certain inner lustfulness, to desire to fulfill a certain inner soul longing, in such a way that the fulfillment of these desires had to come from outside themselves. Then, after people had left the church for the day, they did not want to have something like what had been offered there fully penetrate their lives. This has been said often enough, of course, but for a long time nothing has been done about it. The situation is similar in regard to other things that are spoken of these days. You can probably guess that as well. It would be wrong to say that most young people go through the doors of their universities with a certain inner glow, that they await what their teachers have to say, following up on the things said the day before with a powerful inner warmth. In a far greater number of cases, it would seem, people sit through their lessons simply because they are obligated to do so, or maybe many of them do not go to their lessons anyway, and they are happy if they are able to cram enough to pass their exams. These exams really do not tell us whether a young man, for example, is going to be a capable, competent person. Instead, they tell us whether he has within himself the things that will make him a good theological or juridical bureaucrat, meaning that he will be able to integrate in a prescribed way into the state structure. We will see that under these conditions, which were active during the last few centuries, and particularly during the 19th century, the understanding of the effect that the spirit has in human existence has been gradually lost. Think for a moment about how truly effective religion would have become if it had not moved away from this understanding for living spirituality. All the religions that have now become official religions did not originate in the place that official religious life now sees as its foundation. That is, in the idea that everything we carry within our spirit is just an ideology, a collection of abstractions. Religions originated in the understanding that an objective spirit present in the world revealed itself through certain individuals, and that in this way it had its effect upon the world, that spirit is something actual, a genuine power. Most people who are part of contemporary religious life understand nothing about this. Recently, it was very interesting for me to experience the following. I spoke out of the thoughts that are at the basis of the first chapter of Toward Social Renewal, that is, from a spiritual perspective. An essential part of the proletariat question is that the modern proletariat sees all spiritual life, customs, rights, art, religion, science, and so on, as ideology. And that in this understanding of the spiritual life as ideology lies the basis for an obliteration of the soul, which instinctively brings us more or less to the contemporary social movement. I outlined this in my book Toward Social Renewal. Recently I spoke about it in a lecture, and a professorial discussion participant understood the matter so well that he said something like, quote, "Now you have said that in regard to spiritual matters, the proletariat live in a kind of ideology. But one cannot say that because people in all classes, all life situations, the whole of humanity, are constantly living in ideology. It goes without saying that everybody lives in ideology." Close quote. The gentleman had absolutely no concept of what I meant, because any concept of the reality of spiritual life had already been lost to him. For him, it was entirely self-evident that our spirits and our souls are filled with nothing more than ideologies. As a good citizen, he thereby could not see any alternative except to say that we all live quite justifiably in ideologies. If the proletariat are living in an ideology, it cannot be the reason for the social impulses of the present. You see, these things are so fundamental in our time, even in those who are, in quotes, educated, that we have no choice but to say that people have absolutely no understanding of productivity in spiritual life. Above all else, we must give people some concept of this productivity in spiritual life, of the creative spirit, of the spirit's power. This is of the utmost importance. This is the one thing about which we may have no illusions. If we do, then we will not understand how we can speak to people now. Another obstacle that is important to know is that because of the particular form of social life that has appeared in the last few decades, any awareness of the needs of others has been fundamentally lost. Without this awareness of the needs of others, there can be no true form to economic life. Economic life can be truly formed only by people who, in their thinking about economic life, are capable of looking beyond their own needs, and who have a feeling for the needs of others, through which they learn to feel a part of the whole of humanity. An understanding that is full of insight for what we can call humanity's collective consumption, this is what is needed in economic life. Economic life consists of production, trade, and consumption. But controlling production, assigning to production its proper power, this is not primarily an aspect of economic life. You will see it in Toward Social Renewal. Capital is brought into circulation primarily by the spiritual branch of the social organism. The manner in which things are produced is thus a spiritual question. The question of consumption is, in essence, an economic question. Naturally, those who are a part of economic associations need to have the possibility, which comes from spiritual life, of controlling and organizing production. But the intensity of production, the means of production, can be truly recognized only when you have an awareness of the needs of other human beings, not only for your own small group. But what has appeared in recent life? All over in those Schwätzanstalten that we call parliaments, this is a literal translation and so entirely justified, today we will, without falling into chauvinism, use this German translation for parliament. Everywhere in these Anstalten, there has been a move toward the formation of interest groups. The Association of Industrialists, the Confederation of Countrymen, and so on. In the now collapsed Austria, there were four economic interest groups at the root of the chinwagging, Schwetzismus. Thus, precisely the opposite of what leads to true economic understanding has actually been active in recent history. Interest groups, meaning people who were there and saying from the outset, quote, I'm going to decide what I think is right based on my interests in the matter, close quote. In economic life, decisions can be made only when we are able to distance ourselves from our own individual interests and be aware of others' interests. Several years ago, I wrote about this in the series of articles that appeared under the title Theosophy and Social Questions, German Theosophie und soziale Frage. There, with a certain assertiveness, I formulated the things that I am saying now. But you see, when it comes to such things, I was not just speaking off the cuff, otherwise I might as well have said it in Parliament, in the Schwetzanstalt. I always meant to communicate something that found greater resonance, something that spoke to all of humanity. Back then I stopped writing about it, because nobody took any notice. Of course, there were some interested in it theoretically. But for a long time now, it has not been enough to have merely a theoretical interest. The active social forces that appeared naturally in humanity in earlier centuries are gone now. At present, we need words that can also translate naturally into new active social forces. What I mean by this will perhaps be clear to you after I say the following. Take the most radical socialists, the communists, the Lenins, the Trotskys, and the others. Take them all. Do these people start with some sort of primary principle of social life? No. They take as their frame something that already exists. Even Lenin and Trotsky do not use anything even remotely objective as their foundation, but rather the pre-existing state. Even the communists do not make use of anything objective, some field within a self-contained economic life or something similar. Instead, they take existing frames and go from there, because they do not trust themselves, no matter how radical they might be, to create altogether new frames. They do not trust themselves actually to begin at the beginning. Just take a look at another area of society. Great numbers of people now, even educated people, are converting to Roman Catholicism. There is a young Catholic party forming, and it will probably take on very strong dimensions. Why? Because people today do not trust themselves to seek the beginnings of spiritual life in their own souls. Because they do not trust themselves to begin with something that is truly original. They want to lean on something that already exists. They want to take shelter within something that is already there. Strong inner activity created out of something truly original is not something that people want. They do not trust themselves enough to pursue that. This inner activity, however, is precisely what we need. We must awaken an awareness of it in others. This is what we need now. It is high time that a sufficiently large number of people in European civilization come to an understanding of this. This is what we need, to begin with truly original principles, and not to lose ourselves in abstractions thereby. At the time I wrote in my article, titled Theosophy and Social Questions, that social life will be able to become healthy only through people who act on the basis of the interests of others. Those who are interested only in abstractions normally protest against this. Quote, that is nothing new. That has been said for a long time now. Close quote. If we then ask where and by whom it has been said, we then learn by Schopenhauer. He said quite correctly, quote, "Preaching morality is easy, founding morality is hard." Close quote. Morality must be founded upon empathy for others. Yes, you see, here you have the abstraction. In Schopenhauer, you find an empty abstraction, which, such as it is entirely correct. If you wanted to be abstract, you could say, quote, "Having an awareness of the interests of others is what it means to have empathy for them." Close quote. But in saying this, you have taken the concrete fact that leads you to take it up in life and turned it into a shadowy abstraction. And with this shadowy abstraction, you give people something that makes them very content. When you present people with concrete ideas, as is attempted in the literature about the threefold social organism, then opponents come and say, quote, "All of that is already out there." Close quote. If we then look up what they are referring to, we find that they are all shadowy abstractions. One person finds that Schopenhauer's lesson on empathy already contains everything that I have said to you today. Another person finds it in Kant's categorical imperative, and so on. This is a point that we must examine closely in order to discover the possibility of seeing the essence of the matter. And so, it is necessary that we not speak about what is true on the basis of any sort of prior judgments. Rather, we must always allow the truth to be dictated to us by the things that surround us, must allow ourselves to be taught by what others have, and above all, by what they do not have. But in order to do that, it is necessary for us to familiarize ourselves truly with what lives in the present. You see, it is true that we must defend ourselves against the attacks that are now being launched from various sides against anthroposophy, and also against the threefold social organism. But defending ourselves is not all that we must do. We must be fully conscious of this. We can still defend ourselves against certain streams of the present, out of which these attacking individuals come, individuals whose particular attacks are pointless to defend oneself against. Take, for example, a certain religious Dadaist who recently wrote an article entitled Die Tat, The Act. Michel is his name, a true religious Dadaist. This is actually the only way to describe him. Now, you can defend yourself against such an attack as much as you like, but with a person like this, you will never get anywhere. Because what is based in anthroposophy, what is based in the threefold social organism, he does not understand one word of them. For example, this person has the idea that he should only express himself using nouns when he writes, although he is always speaking about grace and everything that Catholicism has given him, in his feelings and in his way of understanding things. He is, as befits a religious Dadaist, entirely materialistic. So, when he hears that someone has to dissolve these hardened nouns in order to think truly about the spiritual, he calls this the, quote, "explosion of good style," close quote. From his perspective, this makes perfect sense. But in a discussion or a defense against such attacks, you will get nowhere. Of course, you can give people who say such things a good slap on the wrist, that is all well and good, but you will not get anywhere in these matters solely by putting up a good defense. And we must be wholly conscious of this if we intend to be effective in the world. It cannot be that we simply defend ourselves against attacks launched against us. That may be necessary sometimes. But what is really important is that we familiarize ourselves completely with the streams running through these times, with the directives that are out there, and that we then unflinchingly describe them to the general public. The mindset of an individual like Michel or someone similar is really not important. What matters is this particular form of religious Dadaism. That stream must be accurately described to the general public. Herr Michel is of no interest. of interest is this particular form of religious impotence that becomes an active stream at present, a trend. We must describe this in such a way that those people who are still out there, with a healthy feeling for the truth, see what is really going on in the mirror we use, so to speak, to reflect these streams back to them. Naturally, this is much more difficult than simple dialectical defense, but it is also extremely necessary. We must familiarize ourselves with the things that underlie our present civilization. Then we can take them by the roots and set them in the light of the present. As far as that goes, a good bit is already contained in the material out there from the lectures I have given since April 1919. In those lectures, I always tried to point out certain active so-called spiritual streams and economic streams in a particular way, and also to describe certain individuals in the way that they must be described. But the things that I said have mostly been allowed to die since then. They are out there. They have certainly been read, but they need further work. The suggestions must be taken up, must be carried forward. This is what is important in our time. Then, gradually, we do not have much time left, and that gradually cannot last too long now. In our threefold social organism, movement, something will come into existence that will be a positive, fruitful critique of all present civilization. And upon this foundation of a penetrating critique of present civilization must be built what will put positive ideas into our heads and into our hearts. People must come to see the way in which those things that are found in current trends, things that are mostly just reheated versions of older trends, splinter our society. For if they come to see how splintering those trends are, they will be persuaded to turn toward the positive and concrete things that we can say to them. The people in leadership roles right now are all drifting about in illusions. As long as catastrophe does not come from one corner or another, people will be inclined to deny that there is any danger. This is one of the most characteristic aspects about the present. Therefore, we must each renew our efforts every day to show other people the way that what they prefer to keep clouded and out of sight will lead to splintering. It is particularly interesting, with this in mind, to study how leading individuals fear... began to affect things even as we started to form our threefold social organism movement in 1919. Even back then, although it was not more than a few weeks long, there was a general fearful hubbub. In those first weeks, you could see very clearly just how certain industrial and commercially minded people half begrudgingly posed the question, which of course arose in a way specific to them, quote, "How can we come to terms with the socialists? How should we do one thing or another?" Close quote. And they deigned, even though they are mostly working with caricatures of questions about socialism, nevertheless they did deign to speak about such matters. Then a few weeks went by. The socialists did one dumb thing after another, and then the leading individuals of old were in charge again. This is an interesting movement that can be observed currently, for it showed just how strongly people resist transitioning into inner activity and instead give themselves over to what already exists, working out of what is already there, and not making it clear to themselves that we are dancing on the edge of a volcano. Even now, it is the case that most people do not understand this at all. This is why it is so necessary for us to call up an understanding for the fragmentation of society in all circles of the world. How you go about achieving that understanding yourself is what we will discuss in these lectures. Today I wanted to highlight some of the formal aspects of our work and show you where we should be directing our thoughts. You will not come to represent a cause effectively through anything external alone. For a long time, human education was necessarily a theoretical one. And now, all students have theoreticians breathing down their necks, including those supposedly learning something hands-on, since their practical experiences are really nothing more than routines. They each have some set of theoretical phrases that are then to be, quote, implemented in reality, close quote. This is why so-called hands-on teaching, practical experience, is so ineffective now. It is completely ineffective because people are being taught to be theoreticians. Our entire school system has been constructed in such a way as to intellectualize people, to make them into theoreticians. And this is what we must come to, that when we act on something, we stop doing so in a purely theoretical way. Every word must be an inner action. It is extremely interesting to immerse yourself, for example, in the debates that are going on in national economics about the fact that only physical work produces anything good, and that spiritual work does not, that spiritual work is wholly unproductive. In the national economic literature, you will find this said in many different ways. And indeed, two of the most influential leaders in national economics in the 19th century took this statement as an axiomatic basis for their work, Karl Marx and Rodbertus. Both supported the view that spiritual life does not produce anything worthwhile, that only physical labor produces anything worthwhile. This perspective should be understood as historical. But the way in which it is presented is based on a thinking that goes something like this. The portion of the physical labor that has been engaged to produce something is used up, and the exhausted power of that labor must then be compensated and recouped. An idea, on the other hand, is not exhausted when you have discovered something, when thousands and thousands more things can be based upon that model. This argument is often made, but it is nonsense. If you really were to calculate how much energy is required to discover an idea, you would quickly see that the exhausted powers that must be recouped are no less than those used up in physical labor. Because, in fact, everything that is carried out in thinking is as dependent upon the will as those things carried out by the hand. It is not at all possible to separate these two things. It is absolute nonsense to differentiate between head and hand labor in reality. But these have, over time, become empty phrases. Because there was a tendency in the last few decades to make what was once factually real into empty phrases. If you have experience in these matters, you can follow this process every step of the way. I remember, for example, hearing a lecture given by the socialist leader Paul Zinger to members of the proletariat. There were a few people there who had just begun to speak a little bit about those with a, quote, writerly soul, close quote. You should have seen the way in which old Zinger, in his corpulent state, rebuffed them, and responded that he would not stand for having the practice of spiritual work put on the same level as other labor. That was back at the beginning of the 1890s. Since then, it is possible to observe how reality has moved toward empty phrases in the general character of socialism as well. Such observations depend upon your finding your way into life, and then speaking out of life itself. Naturally, not everyone can do this between now and tomorrow, but it is possible for us all to have an understanding of this idea. And if you have this understanding, then certain imponderables will find their way into your speaking, and then your speaking will already turn into something that bears fruit. This is what I wanted to say to you as a kind of formal introduction today. The end of Lecture 1.